The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. That was all a bit silly, wasn't it? Aston Villa 7, Liverpool 2, Manchester United 1, Tottenham Hotspur 6. All that after the greatest one-all draw of all time at Elland Road, Everton purring away at the top of the table, and West Ham convincingly winning two games in a row. We'll round up all the Premier League action, but if your team's game wasn't that interesting, please accept our apologies for not spending too much time on it. We don't have an anti-Southampton agenda. You've asked lots of questions, mainly, what is going on? Who knows? This is The Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning. Hello.
Hi, Max. How are you?
Yeah, I'm really good, thanks. I had a lovely weekend watching some batshit crazy football. Philippe Auclair. Hi.
Hi. Same here.
Yeah. And I presume same for you, Lars.
Hi, Max. Yes, I watched all the football. It was weird. Yeah. I was half expecting the sort of the night with the chicken from Monty Python to come in and knock everyone outside the head. Like, this has gone too far now. This is nonsense. We need to reset.
Lots of people saying so the Premier League needs to turn itself off and back on again. Pizza Guy says, what rule changes do we need to add some goals into this game? SBT87. Is this what happens now that the game is gone? If so, I prefer it. 144 goals scored in 38 Premier League games so far this season. An average of 3.79, the highest goals per game ratio in the top flight since 1930-31. And Ashish says, is a Manchester United fan, says, I sincerely thought Liverpool were winning 7-2 when I glanced at the score. I didn't realise it was Villa's 7. I was feeling really sad after that United defeat. Let's begin then at Villa Park. Aston Villa 7, Liverpool 2. Do you know what? It's really fun just to say it out loud. Dylan says, I support Aston Villa. I've been doing so since 1992. We don't beat the best teams in Europe 7-2. That's the job of other more successful clubs. Can you please tell me how I'm supposed to feel after that match? I'm still not certain that this is real life or a glitch in the Matrix. It was after a weekend which got progressively more fun, Barry. This was just brilliant, wasn't it?
Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I mean, I texted you yesterday on the group chat and said that because I'd watched four consecutive games on Saturday, my brain was fried and I didn't think I'd be able to go in too heavy yesterday. But I watched another 3.5 games yesterday. And I think with the exception of Arsenal, Sheffield United, I enjoyed every single game I watched over the weekend. Villa, Liverpool, you know, top billing, and it was well worth the wait. I keep hearing and seeing people on Twitter trying to, you know, how can we make sense of this? And I don't think we can. It's, you know, it's like if you walked into a farmyard and heard sheep mooing and saw cows walking backwards and pigs flying around the place, you just, well, I don't know what's going on and I can't explain it. I think maybe it's something to do with the fact that there's no crowds and players are perhaps of a mindset that there's a bit of a practice match aura about these games, which are actually league games. Maybe they forget they're going out on telly and that we're all watching. It's like, you know, if I'm singing into my hairbrush in front of a mirror, but, you know, without being aware, there's cameras in the background broadcasting my every move on live television. I'm really enthusiastic in getting into it. But I love this game. A couple of Liverpool players seem to have sort of been unluckily scapegoated. I think Adrian's terrible mistake, you know, got the ball rolling for Villa, but I thought otherwise there was very little he could do. And Joe Gomez seems to have been singled out for a particular amount of criticism when I think there's more than enough to go around all round. The one thing I suppose you could say, I wish Jordan Jarrett Bryan was here after saying last week that he didn't think Aston Villa's manager was quite up to the job. I kind of disagreed with him at the time. I didn't say anything, but I was sniggering away to myself last night wondering how he was feeling. But I suppose he could argue that Villa were incredibly lucky in this game. You know, one terrible mistake by the Liverpool goalkeeper, three mad deflections. They missed four good chances. Were they actually any good? did they deserve to win? I don't know.
I texted Jordan Jarrett Bryan and he was like, oh man, Dean Smith has, he said, Dean Smith has really mugged me off. And he said, my DMs are active at the moment. I mean, you say that, Barry. The thing is, Lars, one of the weird things about looking at Aston Villa 7, Liverpool 2 is Villa really should have scored more, shouldn't they?
Yeah, I think what happened at the weekend, we're seeing the result of a cunning plan devised by the Premier League and the FA and other dark forces who saw last week that there was so much talk of handball and IFAB and all this sort of boring stuff. We need to really change the narrative here. So, I mean, I'm not saying this definitely happened, but what if, like, they all have these personalized drinking bottles now. So I think maybe they picked out sort of a random group of drinking bottles for the weekend and filled them with some pretty powerful hallucinogenics and just sort of just let rip and see how that goes. I mean, maybe that can explain what happened. No, I think it's funny because I think one of the last times I was on the pod, we were discussing this sort of bizarre collapse Southampton had in their game against Spurs. And I think there were echoes of that here with this sort of, if you're going to play with a high line like Liverpool does, like, let's not pretend like the high line thing that Liverpool does doesn't work. I mean, they conceded the fewest goals in the league and won, and it's been really good for them. But the thing is, when you play that way, if it doesn't work a tiny bit, then it goes tremendously wrong very fast, or certainly it can do, because you can get exposed very badly. And if I'm being serious for a minute, I think if you look at, we talk a lot about it's all different this season. The circumstances are strange and unusual. If you look at what's actually different, teams haven't had a full normal preseason, so they're not quite right physically. They've not had time to work on tactical stuff. There's more games than usual, so they might be a little bit tired. They haven't had time on the training ground to work on tactical stuff. And all this sort of stuff, I don't think it benefits teams who play with a high line. I think that's such a... It's like when you like walking one of those tightropes between a building and another building or something. Like, you either do it really well or you probably shouldn't do it at all, because it can go tremendous.
Sure, but it's not as if that back four haven't had practice doing it.
No, for sure. But we've not seen it go quite so spectacularly wrong, I don't think. And I can't help but think there must be a link between these sort of unusual circumstances. I also do wonder if the no crowd thing comes in there, because, I mean, I don't know. It just stands to reason, and it's going to be hard to prove one way or the other, that if you have sort of 50, 60,000 people, 40,000 people sort of shouting at you, you're probably less likely to switch off at any point than if it's just a sort of cavernous, empty ground. So maybe that sort of thing can happen. I don't know. I also wonder if teams are more likely to switch off and give up once they go a couple of teams and goes down when there aren't 100, when loads and thousands of people shouting at them. That might also be an option. It could also be the hallucinogenics. I mean, I don't know. It's
I also like how you're just casually changing the capacity of Villa Park with 40,000, 70,000, 100,000.
It's 40 something, isn't it? Or
yeah, I think so. Philippe, can we talk about Aston Villa? I mean, Grealish was superb.
He was magnificent.
I don't think I've seen Ross Barkley play that well.
Nope.
And Ollie Watkins scored a hat trick. He was a lot of money, and a lot of people who don't watch the Championship will not have seen him at Brentford. But it wasn't just his goals. His all round game was brilliant. His strength, his hold up play, everything.
Yeah, you could start with Konsa as well, was excellent, and Tyrone Mings had a decent game. Well, you could carry on through the whole team, but the one who really stood out for me, like everybody else, was Jack Grealish. And I was thinking, we'll come back to Watkins in a second, but I think in many other countries, and maybe I'm going to be shot down in flames for saying that, he's exactly the kind of player you would build a national side around. He's a very special player. He's the kind of player that people say that English football has been missing and lacking for a long time, a creator. Somebody who can come in from the flanks, can play in the middle as well. Somebody who is a finisher as well. And it's a bit of a mystery, to be honest, from the outside. I mean, I don't know what you feel about it, Max, but and what the others think about it. But that was the kind of performance for me that, I mean, is, yeah, of an absolutely top player. And Watkins, I mean, it's the calm, I suppose, of the player, which really struck me. And you know, he was not a striker to start with, Watkins, by the way. He was a number 10. When he started his career, it's only later on, I mean, he's still very young, of course, that he actually progressed and he was played, he used to play off the centre forward, and then he became a centre forward only recently when he was at Brentford, and with great success. And he's clearly one of those players who hasn't seen a kind of jump of level between one division and the next. And I also think, to come back to what Barry was saying and to what Lance was saying, the absence of crowds does play its role in there. The pressure is just not the same. It's a different kind of pressure. It's a pressure on your capacity to focus. It's a pressure for you, on you, for your absolute, your professionalism. It's also a lack of pressure for teams which like to play from the back. And I'm thinking of Arsenal and Everton here, who are playing from the back. And if they were doing that in front of their crowds, usual crowds at Goodison or the Emirates, there'd be people absolutely howling at them, and they would probably fluff it. So all of this puts together, and it's a kind of a leveling. And so what you get is chaotic, but not completely illogical, if that makes sense. And Villa actually, you know, they clearly have brought in the right kind of players. And as for Ross Barkley, he had a very good game in a kind of Ross Barkley kind of way, because he should have had a hat trick. But have you ever seen him playing in this kind of configuration before? It's the actual question. Because I can't remember him having this kind of impact on a game, perhaps because I haven't seen him deployed in that kind of role very often before.
All I could think was, I don't want to add to the anti-pod Frank Lampard agenda, but going, Dean Smith's got more out of Barkley in 35 seconds.
I do think Barkley is a good player who thrives on that sort of chaotic game where there's a lot of back and forth, and there's a lot of space to run into. I mean, he's someone who's technically and physically very gifted. I think the criticism of him has been sort of decision-making and his tactical capacities, but in this sort of slightly helter-skelter affair, it seems to suit him very well. I also do wonder with Liverpool, like, not, we don't want to harp on about the high line, but I think back to what Marcus Bean said last time we were discussing this on the pod. It's one thing having that plan, and there's nothing wrong with having that as a plan. It can be very effective. But when it's going wrong so many times, surely at some point some game management from the players has to come in. And you have to say, someone needs to say, this isn't how we usually play, but guys, this is going so wrong all the time. We need to drop off a little bit here.
100% record for Aston Villa, Barry. It's good for the league, isn't it? I mean, it's good that Liverpool lost as well, because they won so many games in a row at the start of the last season that it just feels open. Like, I don't think anyone thinks Aston Villa will win every game this season, or Everton will win every game this season, but it's just nice to see different teams there, isn't it?
I think Everton are looking like they might win every game this season. I'd say they're looking forward to their next Premier League game, which is against Liverpool. It's brilliant. I wasn't particularly looking forward to this season, I have to say, because of the whole COVID business and the sterility of not having crowds at games. And it certainly grabbed my attention.
On the subject of Matty Cash, who's also a good signing, isn't he, for Aston Villa. Paul says, wouldn't the Aston Villa fullbacks make a great odd couple detective pairing? Matt Target, uptight, by the book detective, paired with wild young detective Matty Cash. He'll break the rules and doesn't listen to authority. Target and Cash, you can see him because Matty Cash looks like the ladies' man. Matt Target definitely came from accounts. I thought, I'm definitely going to put all my money into trying to get Target and Cash onto Alibi TV. Let's move on to, you've touched on Liverpool not being great, Lars, but how can we account for them losing 7-2 at Aston Villa, Philippe? I mean, that's not just a bad day at the office. That's extraordinary.
It can happen. It can happen that team of that quality. But first of all, I think you've got to acknowledge the fact that not having Alisson and having Adrian, even like Barry said, he was not the only one who had a very poor game. But the stats are pretty tough on Adrian. I think he's had as many errors leading to goals in his time as Liverpool as Alisson, who's played quite a few more games. So that's a bit problematic.
There was one brilliant moment where Watkins hit the bar and Adrian had just sort of wandered off. And Jamie Carragher, who by this time on commentary was mildly hysterical, was just like, where's the goalie? And sort of bursting out laughing. It was so funny. Anyway,
it looked like someone had pushed the wrong button on FIFA. Like, if you just suddenly make him run away.
But there was something I think you could feel from the very start, is that something was missing in the rhythm. The passing, Liverpool. Actually, I'm looking at my notes I was taking at the time. And I think my first note was that no rhythm, so sloppy. And that was within like 3 minutes of kickoff. And you could feel that normally this kind of psychic fluid, which is circulating between the Liverpool players, was absent. So is it because Alisson wasn't there? Is it because Sadio Mane, who is so crucial, wasn't there? Is it because Roberto Firmino, are we allowed to say that, is having a very poor season and has been actually below what we've come to expect of him for quite a while? I also was looking, and Liverpool's bench, there were no solutions on it. This is the bench against Villa. We're talking about the champion of Europe, of England, and of the world. James Milner, Jordan Henderson, Curtis Jones, Minamino, Divock Origi, Kelleher, and Nico Williams. That doesn't feel like the greatest bench of them all. And I can think, for example, you could argue that Tottenham's bench was stronger than Liverpool's bench this weekend.
So what's happened? Liverpool have...
No, it's just a conjunction. You know, you've got quite a few players, very important players missing, and sure, we should add Thiago Alcantara to that. Mm-hmm. Perhaps as well, I don't know, the prospect of the international break coming, underestimating Aston Villa, the fact of losing Alisson just before the game. You could carry on. And simply, you know, days when the rhythm is not there. And for a team like Liverpool, which relies on this kind of beat, constant beat, it's like suddenly a team of musicians, you know, it's like there's the orchestra, there's no bloody leader to give you the tempo any longer. So everybody starts improvising and it's a fucking cacophony. And so, yes, it's inexplicable. But the difference is that Liverpool is going to happen once. Manchester United, it's going to happen every weekend, or almost, I exaggerate. But it's not going to be repeated. Yeah. It's not going to happen again.
It's interesting you say that. And Lars, you tweeted after the United game, what a shame that Roy Keane wasn't in the Sky studio. But what a shame he wasn't there to ask Jurgen Klopp if they were sloppy today.
Yeah, I mean,
yesterday.
What a day for him to not be there. It was a disaster.
Let's go to that game then. Manchester United 1, Tottenham Hotspur 6. Lads, it's Tottenham was the Spurs' official tweets. Social media was in overdrive. Tom McGee at halftime, Man United fan. Not going to lie, lads, it's going to take one hell of a new official tyre partner to cheer me up now.
Brilliant.
Our mate Charlie Baker saying, maybe it's Manchester United that David Moyes is managing from home. And Chris, I'm a Liverpool fan. Is this what it was like for United fans watching us in the 90s? Before we get into the crisis at Old Trafford, should we start with Tottenham, 13 goals in two games, their biggest ever win at Old Trafford. And as Gary Neville said in commentary, Barry, after the first 30 seconds, where to be fair, Manchester United was sensational, when it was 11v11, Spurs were all over United.
Yeah, absolutely. Apart from that initial penalty when they went 1-0 down, they absolutely monstered them. I don't think it's a huge coincidence. You could say maybe the Liverpool-Villa result was an aberration, a one-off, and Liverpool's performance was an aberration and a one-off. But Manchester United have played three league games this season. They got battered in the first one. They were very lucky to win the second one. And they got absolutely slaughtered in the third one. If I was a Manchester United fan, I'd be very worried. Their defence was all over the place yesterday. I said on Thursday that Eric Bailly had played brilliantly against Brighton in the Carabao Cup, and he did. And I said he probably played his way into the starting lineup for this game, and he had. And he was disastrous, as was Harry Maguire alongside him. Luke Shaw was diabolical. Armand Bissaka didn't do much. And the midfield was completely overrun, non-existent.
Yeah, could you find an adjective for Paul Pogba's performance, please, Barry?
Well, I was just getting to him. He was, again, not just anonymous. He was, towards the end, just petulant and anarchic, and then gave away the penalty against Ben Davis, which was just almost childish. Serge Aurier's goal... He was jogging along and let Aurier completely sprint past him and score his goal to crown an uncharacteristically brilliant performance by Serge Aurier.
Yeah. Arise, Serge Aurier. As I said, before we do the deep dive into the United crisis, which Barry has already thrown himself into.
Sorry.
That's all right. Son has 7 goals, 3 assists in 6 games. Kane's got 8 goals and 7 assists in 8 games. you add Gareth Bale to this team, right? And I mean, it just seems ridiculous that after the Everton game where Spurs were so bad, I was ready to say, you know, Mourinho has forgotten football. He should be cast into a giant pit and Spurs are hopeless. Are Spurs now really good, Philippe?
I wouldn't go that far. No, they are very good. And also, the way they've been dealing with this crazy schedule is pretty remarkable. And I think one very good news as well for them is that you finally saw what Tanguy Ndombele can do.
Yeah, what a joy, eh?
And because at the beginning, when I saw the midfield, I thought Højbjerg, Sissoko, and Ndombele, not too sure about that. Well, it certainly worked extremely well. And so you saw what the real Tanguy Ndombele and why people were so excited about him going to the club. You do have a team that looks really well balanced. You have strength in depth as well, which is one thing, you know, I was mentioning for comparing the benches of Liverpool, which is a bit unfair given the absentees, but they have, he really has a number of weapons, and I don't mean that in the Max Rushton sense, at his disposal.
No, I think we'll find the weapon started on the right flank.
But it's also, I thought Harry Kane was absolutely magnificent, and he has been actually for quite a few games. He's back basically to his absolute best. Which is saying something. The finish of Son, by the way, that little dink was, I mean, sublime, honestly. It's not a word that I use very often, but because he managed to put a little bit of effect and cut across the ball so that the ball would slightly, you know, spin off, you know, a bit like a...
Like a sand wedge, like a little...
Like a leg break, Lee. Yeah. Like a leg break. Yeah. So just that it would deviate exactly the right amount to found the side of the net, which is absolutely a thing of absolute beauty. So, yes, they've answered a few questions, I think, and they will answer a few more. And there are many reasons why Lars is looking so perky this morning. And you too, Max.
Yeah, yeah. This is from Jamie Jackson on United. Farcical, hapless and concerning. An absolute horror show from Manchester United, who on this evidence would struggle to give a Parks team a contest. Equals their record Premier League defeat, 6-1 to City in 2011. I mean, you mentioned their defence. The first goal, Lars, this sort of bizarre head tennis. And then, you know, Harry Maguire doesn't put enough on it. And then Harry Maguire hauls down Luke Shaw as he's trying to tackle Tanguy Ndombele.
You don't often
heavenly.
See a bit of a rogue move that from Maguire. You don't often see defenders fouling their teammates in the box when there's danger afoot. No, there were some catastrophic individual errors. Now, I am slightly dumbfounded by the complete sort of collapse of United's defence. Not just really here, but they were really quite poor and gave up some bad chances against Brighton and Crystal Palace as well. And this is a defence for all everyone complains about them, and they're certainly not passing the eye test at the moment, and the names on the back of some of the shirts don't inspire confidence. They weren't that bad last season. United didn't concede that many goals. Only City and Liverpool conceded fewer, not that many fewer, in terms of expected goals against and all these sort of metrics. They were kind of fine defensively, actually. But it's been a disaster so far this season. And I think that's almost the most worrying thing about this game for United is, okay, you have a game, it's a packed schedule, a lot of weird things were happening at the moment. You start off with some bad individual mistakes, you get a bad red card early in the game, it all comes apart, you concede a ton of goals. You know what? It's embarrassing, it's a shame, but it happens, it's one game and we move on. But the thing that's really concerning is they were bad against Brighton and they were bad against Crystal Palace. So they've been bad in all three games. And that is very worrying.
Yeah, Solskjaer says, I hold my hand up, it's my fault, it's my worst day ever, and worst day for all of them as United players. We've been beaten 6-1 at home by a very good side, but we've contributed a lot to our own downfall. Tarek Panjer, New York Times, our mate, not to bang on about Ed Woodward or to focus all the attention on him, he's probably a nice man, but window after window it's gotten worse. He can't be enjoying it very much either. When the CEO needs his own PR man, it's never going to end well. If you were to have a pie chart of blame, Barry, for United, how much would it be Solskjaer? How much would be Woodward? And how much would be the Glazers?
Well, the Glazers get a lot of grief because they take so much money out of the club. But you can't look at that team and say they've been frugal in their spending. So I would actually apportion them very little of the blame, maybe 15%. I would give Woodward 40%. So that's 55, 45 left. I would give Harry Maguire and Paul Pogba about 25% the 25. So that's 20 left, and that 20 could go to Solskjaer.
Will a lot of people asking, will Edison Cavani shore up the Manchester United defence? It's an interesting sort of window they've had, Lars, isn't it?
Interesting is one word.
Okay.
And I think after a couple of windows where it's been all, oh, we're going to sign young players and predominantly British players because apparently their attitude is much better, I guess. And then now it comes to this, throwing money after Cavani, who I love. Cavani's fantastic, you know. And even at 33, Cavani's a great player and can add something. It's the kind of signing, I thought we were done with this, you know. I thought they decided they're not going to do that anymore. And already, if you look at that team and potential issues, you already have a centre forward playing out wide in Greenwood on the right hand side, and you have Marcus Rashford, who's adapting well to playing out wide, but he's sort of fundamentally a striker as well. So you don't really have a creator out on the flank, and so the wanting to bring in Sancho makes perfect sense, and Ousmane Dembele as a fullback position, okay, sure, but like bring in another striker, I'm not sure. I mean, I don't see the point in that,
especially the kind of striker that Edinson Cavani is, who is a one-touch footballer. He's somebody who shoots first time, heads the ball, is incredibly brave, courageous, everything you want to do. I mean, all these qualities, he has them in droves. He's not a creator at all. He's a fabulous finisher who relies on team providing chances that he can be quicker than anybody else to transform into goals. He's not somebody who works really well when he has too much time to think about what he's going to do. Edinson Cavani is very much this kind of incredibly instinctive kind of finisher. I mean, he's wonderful, but he hasn't played for 7 months.
He's been on a farm in Uruguay, so I mean, maybe that's good preparation. I don't know.
Can we talk about Eric Lamella, the red card, Anthony Martial, Jose, famously on the Amazon doc, told his team to be and. I'm not going to use the C word. That's where I draw the line on the highbrow nature of this podcast. Eric was, you know, did what Jose wanted, right, Barry? Should both get sent off there? Should neither get sent off there or what?
I think neither or both, but I suppose Anthony Martial can't really complain. It was a shithouse move from Lamella. I would imagine his manager was extremely proud of him, and I was interested to see here, you know, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer said, if he was my son, I would let him know what I thought of that. If I had a son, I would also cluck disapprovingly if he did that in a game, and maybe impose a ban, a one-match ban, so he wasn't allowed to play in his next game, see how he liked that. But speaking of Jose, I was desperately trying to think of ways to not give him any credit for this victory, and coming up woefully short. And I wonder if maybe there's a little bit of a Bielsa effect coming into play here, where other Premier League managers are looking at how fearless Leeds are and going, maybe we should try that. And that is perhaps some small way of explaining these extraordinary results notched up by Spurs, who are not characteristically this attacking, and Villa, who are not characteristically that good.
Yeah. Question from Ben, saying, hoping you can discuss Graham Souness's "that's very Latin" comment referring to the Lamella incident with Martial. Xenophobia towards Hispanic Latin American players isn't often discussed. I feel like I've heard exactly this type of comment before. Ozzy Ardiles tweeted, I take exception to the Latin comment of Graham Souness about Lamella. Stereotyping all Latin football players in this way is grossly unfair. It'd be the same as saying that this so-called tackle represents the British way, and then he played Graham Souness absolutely nailing someone. Dave Jones, who hosts Super Sunday and is a lovely fella, apologised for the comment, saying, quote, we'd like to apologise for any offence that was caused and the stereotyping of Latin culture. I saw Philippe and Lars, you actually had quite a sensible conversation on Twitter, which is not the place for sensible conversations, about what Souness said and about you are a Latin man, Philippe, of course.
I define myself, I know it will surprise people, because it's interesting, actually, that Ozzy Ardiles immediately thought that Souness was specifically talking about Latin Americans, when actually Souness mentioned his time in Italy. So he was talking about Italians, and I'm speaking, you know, from somebody who's part of my family, actually quite a large part of my family comes from Marseille and is from Provence. So we are very much Latins. It's Eric Cantona country. Can't be more Latin than that. And I didn't have a problem. I thought it was really clumsy, the way he put it. And that's one thing I feel very strongly about. I feel that the way that Sky went about apologizing for it was totally out of order, because it's not up to the presenter, who is excellent and whom I really rate very highly, to have to do this thing with a wide shot of the studio and seeing Souness being humiliated as he was, regardless of whatever you want to say about, you know, comments you have to say. That's not right. If they had gone to Souness and said, well, could you clarify what you meant about that? I think that would have been the right thing to do. There is such a thing as a football culture, and there is such a thing as Latin shithousery, and I'm proud of it. I claim that as my own and as part of what constitutes, you know, the DNA of Latin football. It's being completely, I think it's being dissolved at the moment, because there's an erosion of football cultures, which means that more and more we play like, you know, the others, like Michael Owen tumbling for a penalty against Argentina in 1998. You know, that was shithousery. There is something incredibly hypocritical about the brute nature of some of the English game. It's an example I've often taken, with Lars and with you, Max, probably. When I talk about Jack Charlton's handball against Portugal in 1966, which is an act of shithousery, which is very Latin, okay, which is a Suarez. Suarez got absolutely crucified for what he did, despite the fact that Ghana were given a penalty and he was sent off. Jack Charlton, you barely ever hear this mentioned. Similarly, in the same World Cup, the worst tackle in football history was committed on Jacques Simon by Nobby Styles. He broke his leg, ended his career. England scored from that move. It's never mentioned. Except in France, we do mention it. So we do have stereotypical views of each other. We have to accept that. All of us are prejudiced in one way or another. It's the way we deal with this prejudice, and we try to see, you know, between almost every prejudice, there is a kernel of truth there. But it might not be that truth. There's a kernel of truth. So what we can do is to see where the truth is and question it, which is why it would have been great if Patrice Evra, who is somebody who grew up in Italy and France, had questioned Graham Souness there and then and said, well, what do you mean by that?
I suppose also it's worth saying that that Luke Shaw tackle, does that fit into the stereotype of how of English players doing brutish things? It was a terrible foul, wasn't it? Anyway, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin at Elland Road. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Leeds 1, Man City 1. Until Sunday, this was going to lead the pod. It was a brilliant game of football. Jeff says, instead of the inevitable Leeds v City, what a great advert for the Premier League. Can we get some analysis? Barry, what a great advert for the Premier League this game was.
It was a brilliant advert for the Premier League. I can give some analysis. It started with City completely dominant, and then Marcelo Bielsa took a while to figure out how to stop his side being overrun, and I think they did well to avoid being overrun in that period. Calvin Phillips was being harried and hassled and couldn't get a foot on the ball to dictate the game as he did, but then he was moved to one side. They started piling the ball towards Benjamin Mendy, who just couldn't cope, and then Leeds got back in the game, scored, and looked like they might win. And both managers were pulling levers and pushing buttons here and there. And it's a game that could have gone either way. And I think a draw was probably the fair result. But sort of there was a period in the second half where it just resembled the kind of games I used to play when we were having kickabouts on the street as kids. You know, no notion of defending. It was attack, attack, attack. And I loved watching it.
It was utterly breathless, Lars, wasn't it?
I thought it was a really wonderful advertisement for what I think is great about the top division football in this country, because we've just come off this chat about national stereotypes and things. Now, I do think this sort of capacity for endless graft is definitely part of one of the stereotypes of British football, and one that very often rings true. But all that graft has not traditionally and throughout history not always been directed in the most intelligent way. But you see here, you have a guy like Marcelo Bielsa, who has his very unique way of setting up a team, but also has very unique demands of his players. He demands an incredible physical effort. And I just sort of see Luke Ayling sort of galloping up and down the flank there for 90 minutes without stop. And you think it really is a perfect marriage of plan and environment and personnel that's happening there in Leeds with Bielsa and that group of players and that whole culture up there. It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, Bielsa is just... There's something so wonderful about him, Philippe. And you know, at the end, sitting on his bucket in the pouring rain and before getting up, he just sort of takes 5 seconds. I don't know what to sort of... Just to think about what's just happened or just to take it in.
It was like that sculptor, the thinker, you know?
Yeah. Yes.
And a point of information, I don't think he had his bucket, Max. He was...
He was just on his haunches.
On his haunches. Yeah. I reckon he'd make a good wicket keeper if he can stay down in his haunches for that amount of time. Must be tough on his hammies.
That really must, yes. Philippe.
Yes, well, I think that Bielsa is somebody who appeals to what is the absolute best or the absolute bestest in us as we love football. I think he is. That's why the Leeds United fans love him. That's why the Athletic fans loved him. The Chilean fans loved him. The Marseille fans loved him. It's because he makes you connect with what you love the most in the game. And he's capable. I mean, the way Ayling played, the way Dallas played, what a performance. I mean, it's absolutely glorious to see what he can get from this group of players. And it's not just the bravery. It's also the fact that some of the moves really take your breath away. And it's one thing I think people always talk about the energy of Bielsa's teams, but... Yet again, there were two or three occasions in that particular game, which for me was the game of the season so far. It was not actually the players who were making the effort. It's as if the ball itself was filled in with a kind of independent energy and finding ways to circulate even more quickly behind those players who are not supposed to be... They're championship players, for goodness sake, most of them. And they come from everywhere. You've got guys who come from Northern Ireland, you've got guys who come from England, you've got guys who come from Spain. It doesn't matter. They play Bielsa ball. And it's this capacity to insuffle, to breathe in, this utter love for football that Bielsa has, which explains why we should love him and revere him and realize how precious he is and how grateful we should be that he's playing with this wonderful Leeds team. Honestly, there are moments they really... I was cheering. I just couldn't believe these reverse passes. Mm. I mean, Helder Costa, what a game he had as well. I mean, and the young, you know, Oveda as well on the wing when he came and make Benjamin Mendy look really, really, really foolish.
There was that really sad moment for Mendy when Ayling went past him and Edison made a really good save, but Mendy was just sort of had his hand on his knee. You know, he's just sort of shattered. It was just at the end of the first half, he was like, oh, it's probably a goal and it's probably my fault and there's nothing it's not like sprinting for the, maybe he can get back. It was just like, this is all over for me. Lars, you had your hand up. How polite.
My DMs are going to be active. No, listen, I hate to bring it back to United again, but you just think back at this game and the way it was played and some of the players who were there when Bielsa came and who were sort of considered sort of mid-table championship players. And the way the psychic fluid, as Philippe said, between them is in full flow. And then you see United put in that performance after the last two performances, and you hear people talk on the TV afterwards and say that you can't possibly expect United to play any better unless they spend like 80 million on a new centre half. And you think, what nonsense is this? Like, I mean, there's a lot that can be done with players from the coaching side of things.
Leicester 0, West Ham 3. Matt says, who would win in a match, Pep's prime Barcelona or West Ham, but David Moyes is as far away as physically possible from the game? Jacob Steinberg tweeting, West Ham's last two performances have been their most complete since I don't know when. So they followed up that 4-0 hammering of Wolves with a very comfortable 3-0 win at Leicester, Lars. Leicester not having a shot on target. Are West Ham now good?
You're preaching to the converted here, Max. I've always been very firm. I was lightly ridiculed by Wilson for saying this, but I do think David Moyes, whatever you think of him, if you put him in charge of a group of fairly decent Premier League players, he can turn them into a reasonably good Premier League team. And I think it's been a weird season. Things have gone here and there, but I mean, I'm not that hugely surprised that they followed up their very nice win against Wolves with a very nice win against Leicester. It was good. I do wonder if it's something about this, you know, the further away from the game David Moyes is, the better they play. Maybe you should just gradually try this out. I mean, he's meant to be isolating now, so this is tricky, but if you can maybe sort of move him to Belgium or something for their next game, and then if they're even better, they could send him to Kiev and just see if this can be progressed all the way to Vladivostok or something, and just he will end up in Fiji and West Ham would just be amazing.
Just on the space station playing the guitar. I mean, and it's scripted for West Ham to lose hopelessly when he comes back to the touchline. There's almost nothing David Moyes can do about that. Mikel Antonio Barry had 10 goals now since sort of project restart, and he played brilliantly again, and he sort of found his place at centre forward. He was asked what he was going to do in the international break, referring to the fact he's not in the England squad, and he was saying, oh, there's a pub in my house. Do you think it's unfortunate not to be in that squad?
I certainly don't think he'd be out of place in it. I think he'd be a good sort of option B or plan B to have in the side. He has been called up before by Allardyce, he didn't get a game, and then he was called up by Gareth Southgate, but he had to pull out of the squad with a hamstring injury. So he has been on England duty before. I don't think he would look at all out of place in the England squad.
And they've got a nice three, haven't they? Fornals.
Fornals was superb.
And Bowen as well. But I loved the Fornals goal. That was absolute park football. I mean, was it Cresswell who punted it as high as he possibly could? And then Fornals was just cleaned through. A lovely first touch.
You don't see many park footballers bringing the ball down like that.
But Fornals was really highly rated at Villarreal when he was there, and was a sort of Spanish under-21 international and someone who was thought to have a big future. He just kind of got lost in the chaos a little bit at West Ham and never seemed to find his place. And there are a couple of players in that squad. Like, I'm a sort of Sebastian Allaire truther. Like, I'll go to the grave with this one. Sebastian Allaire is a good striker if you use him correctly. And maybe at some point that will emerge as well. I mean, there is potential in this West Ham squad. I really didn't get the whole, oh God, West Ham are getting relegated thing that we had a couple of weeks ago. It never made sense to me.
And Lars, but what you were saying about Haller, I mean, look at the strength of the bench they had for that game at Leicester. There was also Yarmolenko, who is a very fine player. Felipe Anderson, who on his day can be a match winner. Mark Noble, of course, the captain. Emmanuel Lanzini was also an extremely talented player. This is the bench, West Ham's bench we're talking about. This is not the bench of a team that we should be thinking of as a possible relegation fodder.
Everton 4, Brighton 2. Everton have won 7 consecutive matches in all competitions for the first time since April 1894-95. Then their next game was against Liverpool, which they won 3-0. Obviously, they play Liverpool next in the Premier League. Thank you to @FilippeAuclair for that statistic. It's 4 wins out of 4 this season. Played well despite no Alan, no Gomez, and losing Richarlison early.
Goalkeeper.
Yeah. And that's the key, I guess, isn't it? You know, like Sigurdsson and Delph can slot in. Ancelotti is building a platform and a team and a style that all the players can adapt to, Philippe.
Yes, very impressively so. And also it's a team that very often in the recent past, certainly since the last season of Roberto Martinez there, has often looked afraid of itself. And it seems the fear factor has disappeared. And for example, when you see the way after the equalizer, you think, oh, here we go again. Maybe they're going to be found out after all. Not at all. They didn't seem to be particularly perturbed by that. They carried on playing their excellent stuff. Tom Davies had one of his best games, I think, for a very long time with Everton. I think their back four is also one of the best balanced back four in the league, with Keane has really impressed me actually of late. I don't know if it's the fact that Mina is showing us what he can do, and you know, you have a really excellent partnership. Digne is a super player, not the most demonstrative, perhaps. Coleman had a great, and you think this terrific back four, loads of options in midfield. And up front, he's also found the way to play Richarlison and Calvert-Lewin, or as Ian Hawkey calls him, Calvert-Lewandowski, who is one of the best headers of the ball we've seen for a while in the English game, actually. And he's found just a balance within the team, and a team which seems at ease with itself. And they've recruited extremely well, which is for a change, because that's not what Everton were exactly renowned for, were they, a couple of seasons ago? And then, of course, you've got, I don't know how long it's going to last, but James Rodriguez showing us what he can do, and what he can do is wonderful.
Yeah, Ancelotti on James. The players with quality do not have a problem settling in. The quality is there because football is not so complicated. Then he said the pitch is always the same. He's clearly never played either at Donkey Lane or on the hill at Ali Pali. But then he said the opponents are always 11. The ball is the same. The goal doesn't move. Football is simple. It was like a beautiful moment of philosophy from Ancelotti. You mentioned no goalkeeper, Philippe. Justin says Pickford clearly isn't good enough. Who is the worst goalkeeper to go to an international tournament as England number one?
But he was good, actually, at the World Cup.
Well, he was good at the World Cup. You're right. I mean,
to remember that.
That penalty shootout, what a great evening that was, Barry. I just thought Shilton in 1990 wasn't up to much, but I was only 10. And maybe that's because I don't share Shilton's politics now that I'm rewriting history. Yeah, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll finish all the other Premier League games. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. A few more Premier League games to race through. Chelsea 4, Palace 0. It seems really anti-Frank Lampard to say Chelsea weren't really that great in this game, but they weren't that great in this game, were they?
No, and listen, to be fair to Frank Lampard, he acknowledged that much after the game. And I mean, I thought this game was a good sort of barometer of where Chelsea are at right now, in the sense that they look like a work in progress, because they kind of are a work in progress, but there's still so much attacking potency in that squad that even if they don't have the psychic fluid yet, I mean, there's still so much individual quality that can tip most games in their favour, really, as long as they don't concede silly goals. And signs of Kai Havertz starting to really settle in there. I thought he had some really nice touches in this game. He's such a nice player to watch. I mean, because he's a tall midfielder who's come to Chelsea from Leverkusen, he gets compared to Michael Ballack. But when you watch him, that's doesn't make any sense. It's more like, I'd like to throw in, there's another player who came from Leverkusen to England who he reminds me more of. So if you were to take Michael Ballack and Dimitar Berbatov into like a big blender, and you make a blend, and then you sort of pour the thing out into a cast and mold it into a person, then I think that would be Kai Havertz, more or less, and I think he's just a lovely player, sort of very, very elegant, little touches on the ball, tall, deceptively quick. I just love watching him, and I think he's going to be fantastic for Chelsea. And this was the first game where you can kind of see where he's going to fit in, aside from that League Cup game, of course, when he scored 50 goals against Barnsley or something. But in the Premier League, this was very good.
Now, after the game, some people organised a surprise birthday party for Tammy Abraham. More than six people did. Seems like a bad idea right now, including Tammy Abraham himself, obviously going to his own party that he didn't know about, Ben Chilwell and Jadon Sancho. So they've breached COVID-19 laws. Tammy Abraham apologised while not really apologising. He said, "I would like to wholeheartedly apologise for the naivety shown by all for the organisation and attending of this gathering. I recognise I have a responsibility both in my professional and personal life to honour and respect the guidelines, and deeply regret that this took place." The FA say there's no plans at this stage for them to not be in the England squad. Obviously, this is after Foden and Greenwood broke the rules in a slightly different way, arguably, depending on who else was at this birthday party, I guess, Barry.
Well, I have this
thoughts?
Image of Tammy Abraham still sulking about not being allowed to take that penalty, and then a load of people jumping out from behind the curtains going, "Surprise!" And he has to put his game face on for the party. It seems pretty cut and dry to me. If Foden and Greenwood are sent home for acting the maggot regarding COVID-19 regulations, then these three boyos should be withdrawn from the squad as well. Possibly an exemption for Abraham because he was the victim of a surprise party. Is there anything worse? But the other two, certainly.
But if Abraham goes, then, you could surreptitiously organise surprise parties for anyone and therefore break the COVID rules for them. I think there's a big difference. I mean, I don't know how many people were at this party. Maybe it was seven. Maybe you know, there were hundreds. I don't know. I think there is a difference between this and...
What is the difference?
Well, I think one is on international duty. One involves... I think it's a worse breaking of the rules. I don't know where the line is. I think they're at different levels, and maybe the line means none of them are in, but I think you could draw a line between Foden and Greenwood and these three, but I might be wrong, Lars.
No, you might be. I do think, yeah, no, I definitely see the point that they weren't off on their travels when this happened, and I think that sets the incidents in a slightly different light. I mean, it's not as if every person who got caught breaching quarantine throughout this ordeal were surreptitiously dropped from England. I mean, Kyle Walker was in the last squad, I believe. So, I mean, I see that point for sure. Just, you know, just don't be so stupid, honestly. Like, the rules are very clear on this. It's not hard. Just don't do it.
It's also worth mentioning that throughout this recording, Lars has been in the top right-hand corner of my Zoom. He's got a hoodie up and he looks like Obi-Wan Kenobi. So... to hear him dispensing this wisdom, it's very fitting.
Don't be so stupid.
Arsenal 2, Sheffield United 1. Philippe, two things to ask you here. One is should David Luiz get sent off? And that is harsh on Sheffield United, given that John Egan got sent off for something very similar against Aston Villa, when Aston Villa went to a turgid 1-0 win against Sheffield United's 10 men. How things have changed in a couple of weeks. But... was that a red for Luiz? Changes the game?
Possibly, yes. I don't think there would have been a lot of disagreement if he had been taken off, even though he barely actually slowed down
Oliver Burke,
the opposite player. Yeah, Oliver Burke. And also, Leno was actually very, very quick off his line. So you could argue it was not a proper goal-scoring opportunity, but never mind. On the other hand, you could say that there was a certain kind of balancing act, referee that said that they didn't want to take the red cards out because the Sonderberg challenge on Aubameyang was absolutely awful. There was a straight red as well. But anyway.
Yeah, anyway, lovely. Saka's header was not an easy header, and Pepe's finish was just a beautiful side foot pass, wasn't it?
And I think Saka's header came at the conclusion of an absolutely superb collective move, of which there were very few, but it seems to be a kind of hallmark of this Arsenal Arteta team. They don't create many, many clear-cut chances, but boy, they're very good at taking them, and even half chances, which explains where they are in the table.
Breaking news, Gunnosaurus will return when fans do, but the man who's occupied it since 1993 will not. At St James's Park, Newcastle 3, Burnley 1. JD says, in what minute of the pod will Max say, he's just a joy, isn't he, about Alan Saint-Maximin? I think about 3 hours in. But his relationship with Callum Wilson, Lars, is looking really strong, isn't it?
It is, and... He's just a joy, Max.
This is clearly a result that will further outrage Newcastle fans, who get more and more upset as their team wins each week. I think that's seven games now, is it? Or six games, four wins, a draw and a defeat. They will be beside themselves with rage because they really can't handle... Success is the one thing they can't handle more than failure.
I'll be honest, though... I watched them at Spurs and I watched them in the Carabao, and I did start to think, actually, I'd hate to be watching this. But they did play well against
this.
Burnley.
This was a great performance against a team that is going, I think, to struggle very, very badly.
Alexander says, a question for the pod. Is there a more do-a-job player in the Premier League than Bardsley for Burnley? A stalwart for Dyche, but would he get into any other Premier League team? And Nifty Palms, I like this question. Do Burnley have the most first-team players that people wouldn't recognise on the street? What the heck do Westwood, Brownhill and Loughton... He called him Loughton. He didn't even spell it right. What do they look like? If the Burnley squad were to ring on your new doorbell, Barry, how many do you reckon you'd recognise?
I think I'd recognise quite a few of them. But, yeah, there are a few. I reckon if Ashley Westwood rang my doorbell and wasn't wearing... Burnley kit, I would not know who he was.
That's right. By association, I guess, if he was stood next to Ashley Barnes and Nick Pope, you put try and put two and two together, wouldn't you? Southampton 2, West Brom 0. Somebody got in touch to say, can we just spend a bit of time talking about that Romeo volley, Lars? It was lovely.
I think in a very hotly contested field, that was one of the oddest things that happened all weekend, because Oriol Romeo is not really a goal getter. I mean, he scored something like 5 goals in his entire career. Since he came to Southampton, he's actually, I've looked this up very quickly, he has a goal a year, so I guess this was his goal, and a jolly good goal it was too.
Finally, Wolves won, Fulham 0. And that's all for today.
Can I just add one sentence?
Of course.
Just that, which is a non-English sentence. It's about PSG and what Leonardo said about Thomas Tuchel, because you don't hear sports directors talk about their current manager that way. Tuchel had complained about the lack of action at the transfer market. Leonardo, speaking to French television, said, and this is, I'm not inventing this, if he doesn't like it here, he can go.
Perfect.
That's at least it's the merit of clarity, hasn't it?
Philippe, always lovely to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lars.
It's good to hear that everything is calm and sensible at PSG, as always. You know, there's never any trouble there. They're such a well-run club.
Tomorrow, Barry, you're in charge of the deadline day, just so you know. Alongside you will be Sid Lowe, Nicky Bandini, Archie Rintup. We'll round up all the transfers and we'll find out what's happening in the European leagues as well.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.